Yes, you are listening to The Architects here on 3RRR. Recovering, Stewie, from a... God, what a big week last week was. Radiothon and all
the fun of the circus. And before we proceed, we should thank everybody who subscribed to 3RRR and The Architects here on 3RRR.
And we do genuinely mean that, because we had a bumper response to The Architects this year.
We had a great response, so thanks for everyone who called in. Regular 3RRR listeners, architectural practices,
students. Subscribers, new subscribers, we had them all. Even the Leader of the Opposition rang in personally.
He did. Ted Bailey, of course, is a former architect, called in and pledged his support for the show, which was great to see. And joining us also in the studio, Mr. Rory Hyde. How are you going?
Good evening. I just thought I'd come and say thanks to everyone who gave us a call last week. Bumper subscription. So really, it is genuinely good to know that people are really willing to put their money down to support a show like this. It's fantastic.
Well, and it's really, is about the station and the idea that 3RRR is the only place that an architecture show can happen. And it does happen, and it's going to continue to happen because people are supportive of it. So it's great to see.
And I reckon we're probably getting up to probably almost triple last year in what we got in subscription. So that's a fantastic response, and we love you for it.
I had a lot of people come up to me and say, you know, what a fantastic community that supports something like this. So, big shout out to everyone who called up. It's fantastic.
Yes, you are the architects, and well done. Plenty of time to continue to subscribe and send your money into all the first. October.
Not just to our show, but to anyone's show. You can subscribe for the next couple of weeks, and you're still in the running to get prizes.
All those great major prizes.
So you haven't missed out, including that five-berth camper down to the Meredith Music Festival, which I reckon is almost the pick of the lot. But there's plenty on there, though.
So many fantastic shows on 3RRR. And tonight, here on The Architects, we talk about architecture, urban design, sustainability, and other stuff. We will be talking to very special guest, Jeff Crosby, who's a well-known Melbourne architect, but whose, I guess, original life was probably better known as being one of the original members of Hunters and Collectors. Mm. We'll be playing some Hunters, Rory, in a very short while.
We just had a dig around the library.
The 3RRR library.
Of that vintage.
I want to say thanks to Clem for transference as well.
Yes, Coast to Coast, Clemo there, as always. Love the Sesame Street work before. Great stuff there.
If you want to have a look at Jeff Crosby?
If you want to look at Jeff Crosby, either be in the green room here at 3RRR or go to crosbyarchitects.com.au. Plenty of work on that website, all really well organised. But first, we should talk a bit about the 11th Venice Biennale of Architecture, which is coming up very shortly. And joining us on the phone is one of the creative directors of the Biennale this year for the Australian Pavilion, and that's Kirsten Thompson. Are you there, Kirsten?
Hi, everybody. Yes.
Thanks for calling in. And tell us, Kirsten, Venice, it's you and a series of others. Who's the team this time?
It's a big one. We've got Neil Durbeck and Wendy Lewin, two architects in Sydney, and Gary Warner and Vince Frost. So there's five of us, and then we've sort of expanded the team with dragging in Conrad Heyman.
The legendary Conrad Heyman.
Yes, the legendary, that's right. So Conrad's been working with us on our historic survey, if you like, and then Ian DeGrucci as well, who's doing some fantastic projection work.
Yes.
Mm. So it's a team that gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
So Kirsten, tell us a little bit about the show this year. What are you guys putting on?
Well, what we're doing, if any of you are familiar with that funny old pavilion that we've got, very lucky to have it, by the way, it's got two main rooms. So the exhibition is in two parts, and we think of the first bit as a snapshot of our past, which is where Ian DeGrucci's projections come into play. We've got about 80, 100 buildings that'll be presented through a series of very immersive slide projections that Ian's put together based on Conrad's survey. And the idea there being to present some kind of historic context to what you're going to be hit with in the next room, which is the snapshot of now. And that's going to feature about 300 models from around the country. I think, Stuart, you've got something in there. So it's going to be overload, really, and the big thing has been how to present a lot of content in a way that's pretty engaging as an exhibition experience. Remembering that people are racing through these pavilions, most of them have got museum exhaustion by the time they get to them. They've done quite a few already, so you really got to hit them with something pretty high energy and engaging. And yeah.
And Kirsten, have you had a chance to see the whole of the 300 models?
We've seen quite a lot of them. We unpacked a few in each of the cities because they're collected from all around the country. So the whole place is pretty well represented. Yep, they range from seriously high concept, hence snake skin pants. We've had the Lions cricket bats. We've had someone who's got a little piece that pumps out, you know, petals every 10 seconds. We've got all sorts of things and much more conventional architectural models. So very, very varied. And I think that variation tells you a lot about the different thinkings that are going into making buildings right now in Australia.
And Kirsten, the theme, the show's called Abundant, and that obviously implies a certain abundance of things. And obviously that abundance is about an abundance of ideas.
Yeah, some people say it's absurd using that word with Australia, given drought and so on. But nevertheless, yes, that's right. It's just trying to, I think, really present, rather than narrowing down a description of our work through a small handful of practices, we thought we would just take a very, very broad sample to really widen the net and just really broaden how people think about what we're doing here, which is not to say that there aren't certain sort of themes or little lineages that you start to see with the collection, but yeah, and I think Conrad's essay starts to try and make a bit of sense of the different approaches that we see in this country.
And Kirsten, when does the party start? What's the
party's starting? It's probably now. I don't know. The first lot of the team are already.
You're not there, right? We must stress. You're still in Melbourne, Kirsten.
I'm leaving Thursday morning. I thought I was leaving tomorrow until I checked my ticket yesterday.
When's the actual
bonus day now?
When's the official opening?
The 14th. Official opening is the 11th. That's when the vernissage starts. So the 11th to the 14th of September is when the press gets access. So it's a sort of media throngs pouring through all the pavilions and saying yay or nay and judging. So that will be, that's next week.
Yes, the vernissage, a word I've become to know well, a word I've never heard.
Well, does it?
Yes, it's a very unique one. And there's a wider theme to the Biennale, which you think is that out there? And does this, how do you fit into that or not? Or is that important?
Interesting. Those thematics are always announced so late in the piece, when probably most countries have already made their selection of their own creative directors. So with Aaron Betsky, who's this year's overall Biennale director, I think that came out early this year when we were well underway. I think we have thought about how the exhibition responds to that, and I think we felt that, you know, there's many takes you could have on what Betsky's proposition is. We sensed that he was interested in how architecture might engage with other disciplines to enrich its makings, but we felt that it was that really for us in this country, ideas are manifest through making buildings, that there is a really rich tradition of buildings themselves, rather than having to stay in the realm of, say, paper architecture, are actually built. And so that's where the model seemed like a really good way of showing it or demonstrating that material beginnings and the way in which architects think through making buildings. So, yeah, that's our sort of partial response to Betsky.
Excellent. And it opens to the public, I think, on the 14th and then runs through, what, till November sometime, doesn't it?
That's right. It's on for a couple of months.
So yeah. If you're in Venice in the next couple of months, you should definitely check out the Architecture Biennale there. Kirsten Thompson, we'll see you. Well, I'll see you in Venice.
Great.
We will hear more about it. And thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Kirsten.
Right, pleasure. See you then. Bye.
With Kirsten Thompson there, and we'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Frédéric Houssard-Andrieux, and you are listening to Architect on Triple H.
Triple H. Simon Knott.
Yes, she says that so well, doesn't she?
Indeed. And what were we just listening to then, Ollie?
We were listening to a track, and that was Patti Smith doing some covers there of the album 12, and that was White Rabbit. And that was brought to us by Jeff Cosby.
Jeff, welcome to the show.
G'day.
And that was one of your tracks there, a bit of Patti Smith. And we'll be playing a few more of Jeff's selections. Obviously, Jeff's got a few musical connections, being a former member of Hunters and Collectors and also now architect in Melbourne, based in Footscray. Maybe tell us a bit about, we might just do a bit about the history, musical history stuff first. What was your involvement with Hunters and, you know, what was that like and what did you do?
Well, I was one of the founding members and I played keyboards and we did a lot of playing. We played every weekend and every second night for years and years.
And we were just talking a bit before about that time in the 80s when there seems to be more gigs on in the city than there are now, and there was a lot of playing, and, you know, there's a very different sort of idea about going out and what you did when you went out.
Yes, we just got a text in from Rory's brother as well, who's about my age too, who's sort of a big fan, as well as I was. We saw Hunters and Collectors play many times. He said, can you yell out the slab to you? Something got yelled out at a lot of Hunters and Collectors.
Yeah, games, I think. Pity we don't have that to play.
Maybe we do.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, well, we should put that on next.
Yeah, there goes my selection out the window. But, yeah, the slab was, you know, that was written in Germany and it was reminiscing about drinking Australian beer, I guess. But we used to get through a lot of slabs in a rehearsal.
And you left the band in 85 after you'd already started architecture before then.
Yeah, I started 75. That's giving it away. And I did 3 years of architecture before I left to go to art school, and art school led to music in a sort of strange way. And then Hunters started in, I think we started rehearsing at the end of 79 and played in 1980. So, yeah, I then played for 5 years before leaving.
You decided that architecture was also something you wanted to go back to?
Not at that. I mean, I don't think I left to go back to architecture. In fact, I know I didn't. It was something I always wanted to do, but I did have 10 years of being distracted from it, you know, and Hunters were only five of that. I did art school and then I went back and started painting and exhibiting and got into making film clips. The slab, I made the clip for the slab.
Right.
So I started doing a lot of film work and worked with homeless kids in Richmond for a while doing film and doing clips for bands like Do Re Mi and Painters and Dockers and bands like that afterwards. So I set up a business doing clips after I left the band.
We were talking a bit before about the St Kilda music scene back in the 80s and telling some stories about you'd be able to see you guys in one place and then you'd be able to walk down and see a birthday party.
Yeah, it was a pretty... It was an amazing time. There was so many bands playing and so many good bands around and, you know, a lot of factions. It was almost like footy teams, you know, people had their favourites. But there were just so many venues to play at. You know, every pub had its band on and you could play there. And, you know, late into the night.
So what happened there? Was it just the sort of pokey scene, you think, came on board with dance music? Or, you know, something went awry
yeah.
in the early 90s, didn't it?
Yeah, I think new romanticism didn't sort of work in the pub so well. It wasn't quite the sort of glamorous, you know, spot for it. But, I don't know. You know, real estate changed things as well. There was a lot of things going on, I guess.
And then when you finished studying, did you straight away decide that you want to practice for yourself, or did you go and work for people first? Or
No, I did it the other way around. I was actually doing work before I went back. I did a job. I guess I'd sort of done as much as I wanted to do with filmmaking and film clips and things, and I'd been doing some painting, but actually, my parents bought a house in. I bought some land up in Gypsy Point near, up on the coast near Eden.
Beautiful spot. Yeah.
And I sort of put my hand up and said, "I'll design you a house." So I bought a caravan and went and stayed on it, and took my drawing board up. And out of that came a few other jobs for musician friends and things. And out of that sort of came a better go back and study. So I went back. So I'd sort of been doing a little bit of practice before I, you know, finished.
Where did you study?
I went back to RMIT. I started at Melbourne Uni, and when I went back, I don't know, RMIT just seemed like a much more interesting place. I tried going back to Melbourne Uni in the 80s, I can't even remember when it was, but it was a very different place to the 70s. It was much more political in the 70s, and it sort of had changed by the 80s.
Kind of slightly more conservative or something.
Yeah, and I just couldn't hack it. So
so who would have been some of your teachers back at RMIT? Did it have Peter Corrigan and those guys? And
They were around. Yeah, I had Corrigan. In fact, I walked out on one of his studios.
Not the only one.
But, there were people like that. There was,
Ian McDougall would have been there.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't there.
A bit too early.
Yeah, he wasn't there then. It was, you know, the late 80s, so.
And this decision, in terms of then getting work as a practitioner, did you get work in terms of music-related work, in terms of venues and those sort of things, or...?
No, it was mainly... I mean, I guess because I'd spent 10 years, you know, between starting and going back, I had all these people that had made a bit of money or had some money or started families and wanted to renovate, you know. So it was mainly renos that I got that started me going. And I did, you know, one after the next of sort of mates and people that knew people. And it sort of grew from there into doing some houses and then from there doing... sort of slightly larger residential developments. So I did, I went from renovations to working for developers for a while.
And one of the jobs that people might know in the city of yours is the Loop Bar. You were involved in design there.
Yep.
Which is a great one, which has had many a great party and night at. And, of course, process talks are on there. It's a sort of video-based sort of thing. What was your involvement there? Was it a sort of new kind of sort of bar to some extent?
Oh, it was. George, who set it up, had a really clear vision about what he wanted to do that, you know, changed through the period of design. But, you know, there was a connection there with film and music. So, you know, when we got together, it was sort of seemed to work quite well. And the music thing changed a bit. He was originally there was going to be a recording studio as part of the bar, but... Mm-hmm. That sort of became sort of obvious that the space wouldn't allow that allow that to happen. But you know, the idea of having two projection screens and having film and you know, that sort of thing working with the DJ with music and that was in there right from the start, and it was a great idea.
I'm interested, Jeff, in how those sort of, you know, how your careers kind of intersected. I mean, do music and architecture come together at any point? Is it just another sort of creative outlet, or are there ways that they cross over?
I always wanted to be an architect. I never thought of myself as a musician, so the music was more me working in sort of soundscapes rather than being, you know, I'm not a proficient keyboard player or anything. Use synthesizers and use sound and use tapes and stuff. So it was more constructing, in a way, it was constructing spaces and stuff. So the music was a sort of accident of, you know, history rather than a desire to get into that. But there is a real similarity between being in a band and being an architect. You know, the way that you have to compromise, you have to work with other people and you know, develop a strong idea that will hold something together is really similar in both, I think.
So would you say that through your art practice and then, you know, making films and all that sort of stuff, it was all about sort of creating those spaces? I mean, this is...
Yeah, I think so. I always sort of fall back into thinking, what am I doing this for? You know, what is the meaning underlying it rather than just, you know, there's I think even with my practice now, I'm sort of moving much more to community-based work. You know, I started with developers and things, and it's a bit of a push away from that now. But it's everything I've been involved in has been around that, trying to find that meaning beyond. You know, architecture is about shelter, and that's, you know, you can do a whole lot of other stuff with it, but it basically it's about shelter, and working out what that means is important. And, you know, music's about bringing people together, and what you can do with those people is important. You know, why you're doing that, not just to do it.
Mm-hmm. I think about this idea of some of those venues we're talking about before, and as an architect, we're always designing new things, essentially, and often the places that have a certain credibility are, by definition, not new.
Yeah.
How, you know, they're old, they're decrepit, or they've got a certain character that's been built through culture or time.
History,
or,
isn't it?
Yeah. How do you, and we're always confronted with the possibility of, well, how do you do that? How do you make a new place authentic? How do you make a good new venue? And do you have any sort of suggestions for how that works?
No, but I'm more and more interested, and it's sort of funny to come back from starting with renovations. I'm more and more interested in working in architecture with existing fabric and existing buildings, and always looking at ways of keeping the structure that we've got. You know, whether it be doing a new house on a suburban lot or doing working with a large commercial building. So I think there's a sort of an essence with the fabric of something that it's like the Docklands, where you sort of, you know, have this fantastic place and then you just push all the ships and everything out that makes it interesting and develop it, and you've got this dead space. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, I mean, how many times are we going to do that before we learn that the good things need to be kept?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Docklands is a great example of that. Well, we might take a quick break and we'll be back with Jeff Crosby right after this.
I'm Mark Dytham from Klein Dytham Architecture. You're listening to Triple R. Architecture rocks, man.
Yeah, it certainly does. And we were listening to Hunters and Collectors there from Under One Roof, a live album. That was, of course, The Slab, going out to Ed Hyde. And we played that one because we've got Jeff Crosby here, former member of Hunters and Collectors in the studio and architect now.
Yes, and just before we go on, I just want to mention a couple of subscribers there in the break.
Still keep on coming.
They can, and you can still do that. Francesca, is that right, Rory?
Francesca?
Yeah, Francesca. You've got a Z in the middle of it. Yeah, Francesca. And Paul, thanks for calling in and subscribing to Francesca to the Actex and Paul to Smoke 'em, if you got 'em. And yes, Jeff Crosby continues to join us in the studio. And Jeff, I want to talk a bit about housing, because you seem to be doing quite a bit of that sort of work, the medium density housing. You talked about your renos originally, seem to medium density, and now onto sort of high rise a little bit as well. And I guess, you know, this issue of mid-density housing is still a really hot one in the Australian sort of consciousness about how do we make it good? Is it a good idea? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think Australians will eventually get used to apartments?
Yeah, there's plenty of people looking for places like that to live. I think, I mean, we're never going to become a European sort of density of apartment living sort of cities. It's, you know, there's a lot more suburban houses out there than there are ever going to be apartments.
Mm. Do you think you could do it, though, we could get closer to that if we just built bigger apartments? What I don't understand, I mean, if you go to Europe and these apartments, they're sort of like, you know, 350 square metre, you know, they're the size of a house.
With bigger outdoor spaces, too.
Yeah, with, you know, the decent outdoor space or a roof terrace or whatever. Like, we build these, I mean, they've just shrunk over the last 10 years down to this, you know, sort of like 70 square metres for a two-bedroom apartment now.
Yeah,
it's tiny.
I mean, they get very tight, but they're, you know, it's the nature of the cost of construction as well, and the sort of sites that are available. It's a very tight market.
Yeah, it is hard to make them stack up. So, it was interesting. When I was up in Sydney just recently, they've got a whole new bylaw system up there in Sydney, a planning law, particularly for apartments, which seems to be working really well. Well, they insist that 70% of the apartments have to have some sort of cross-through ventilation.
Yeah.
So it stops you sort of double-loading apartments on either side of a corridor and getting those kind of solely just south-facing apartments. So basically, you know, 70% of the apartments in the building have to go right through the building at some level.
Yeah.
And it's changed the way that they've... it's changed the whole density structure and the development system in Sydney and producing much better degree of apartments. So
you can do that. We've just done we've just got a planning permit for 25 apartments in Elwood, where we've got every one of them cross ventilated, and we haven't double glazed or put anything special in, and they're still averaging 6 stars. So you know, it just takes more energy, but it takes developers to put the money in for the architects to do the work to get them to work.
And do you find developers are you know, opening themselves up to those sort of things, and do you think there is room to move in the harsh developer model that you've probably been working in?
No, I'm pretty cynical about it. People are still coming in with pretty little experience and wanting to do things that you know, they've seen done elsewhere, and they don't want to spend a lot of time or money thinking about how it's going to be done. But I'm doing less and less of that work anyhow, so I mean, I'm not at the cutting edge of, you know, where that sort of area is going.
One project you are involved with is the redevelopment of the Duke of Wellington Hotel, which I do, relying on my city circle tram as a resource, is the oldest pub in Melbourne.
Yep.
Operating pub, not operating as a pub anymore.
Well, it will be again.
It's going to become a pub again.
Yeah, it's only stopped for the development to happen, and it was you know, its license started in 1853, so it's actually an older, continuously licensed pub to the Young and Jacksons, who
yes.
claim that they're the oldest. But
yes, and there's and your office is doing a tower on the site, coming in sort of behind the existing fabric.
Yeah, that's pretty much completed. It's an 8-story office building behind, but well, 6 stories or 7 stories of offices, and then there's some new additions to the pub underneath.
And was that changed program as well, didn't it, from residential to office? A sort of interesting thing to do halfway yeah. through a job.
Yeah, well, it wasn't. We actually fully documented and tendered the apartment building, and the client decided that he didn't want to do that anymore.
Was that because of change in the market?
Yeah, I don't know. It's the vagaries of that client. I'm not sure
yeah.
why he wanted to do it. I think, you know, it was a good project. No, I think it would have stacked up, but, you know.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about in terms of music and, I guess, architecture is what you might call the Rainbow Hotel Syndrome, the Rainbow Hotel in Fitzroy, of course, which had a large amount of apartments, and countless other examples of this. We get inner urban areas, pubs with good live music scenes, medium-density housing comes in,
yeah.
residents complain, music stops. What's your take on the future of this problem and you know, from seeing it basically from both sides of the equation?
I don't know, it's a tricky one. I mean, people come into those areas and they should be aware of the noise and the life of an area. I mean, I don't understand why people want to change an area that they're attracted to.
Mm.
But having said that, it's pretty hard to control that process. It's almost like pubs and live venues need to be heritage listed or something and protected, because they're just sort of, one after the other, they're closing down. But you know, it's like, I think we were talking before, it's like the Docklands, you know, all the things that my office is in Footscray, and I just love the looking back on the Docklands and you know, all the containers and stuff, but the city side of the Docklands is just, you know, it's something totally different now, and I don't get it at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess what you're talking about there is, in some ways, you know, a new term that's crept in over the last couple of years, an idea about placemaking, and how we sort of, you know, how we kind of engender meaning in spaces and people can take ownership. And, you know, I was talking about it recently about Footscray with someone, and sort of they're saying, you know, how long before that's going to get completely gentrified? You know, it's that close to the city, but it's so rich and it's got so much going on there, and a real mix of demographics there, and you've got your office in there, you used to live there and stuff. I mean, is that part of the sort of community work that you're interested in? Is kind of
I love Footscray, and it is an incredibly rich place, and it's got a really, because of that, it's got a really close sort of communal sense to it on a whole lot of levels. But I think it's, in a way, it's protected a bit. People are still scared of it or still don't understand it, and it's also protected from the city by the docks, and that's another thing that at one stage there was talk of sort of trying to knit it back into the city, because it's only, you know, it's 10 minutes away. But there's something great about the fact that you have to go through that dockland to get to it. It's like you've sort of made a decision to make that journey to somewhere else, and I think that sometimes we need to preserve that. You know, a lot of the closer in suburbs are getting sort of tied in with the central business district, and there's no transition. You just smoothly go from one to another, so you don't know you've reached somewhere else.
Separation can be a good urban thing.
Yeah. And it gives those spaces that can be used for other things, those, you know, sort of dirty spaces.
The sort of empty ones.
Yeah, the bits can be, you know, they need to be preserved in a way.
I wanted to talk to you about a little bit about style, but maybe this question will allude to that, which is one we always ask our guests, which is, who is your favourite architect, either living or dead, Australian or overseas?
I saw that on your list, and I don't sort of truck with that in a way. I don't know. I mean, I've sort of been influenced by a number of people. I mean, Albert Caesar is sort of someone that I really liked for a long time, and I must admit I don't sort of look in that direction anymore. But it's a tricky one. I don't know about. I'm sort of influenced by things outside of architecture more and more these days. So it's sort of, I'll see things and I go, well, I like what that person's doing for a while, and I sort of incorporate, thinking about different architects. But, to say I've got any heroes is, I don't.
Sure. Well, Jeff Crosby, thank you so much for coming onto the show. We're going to finish up, Noddy, with a bit more Hunters.
Yes.
And we'll be back.
This was the first track written by...
Yeah, this is almost, this was pre the band starting, so I think I held an A down for the whole song when Mark was writing the lyric to it.
Well, thanks very much for coming in, Jeff, we appreciate it.
No worries.
Isn't that the case?
Indeed it is. And
I sort of just ran that into the back of the Hunters and Collectors track there, and we were listening to Talking to a Stranger. And
classic early Hunters there, because Jeff Crosby was in the studio. Thanks to Jeff for coming on.
Very early Hunters and Collectors, in fact, preceded the band. And that was Under One Roof, which was recorded at Selena's in Sydney back in 98. And gee, in the photo there, they got those... All apart from Mark Seymour, actually, and Jeff Crosby's not in this photo. Do they sound to really look a bit old here?
Yes, and thanks to Brian, of course, here at Triple R, who helped us sieve through the CD library, as Brian always does, and that is help us out. And we've got another subscriber.
Yeah, a big thank you to Jackson Clements Burrows, JCB Architects, Graham
Better
Burrows.
Better late than never.
Yeah, he's come in with a business subscription, so thanks, guys. And a $1,000 donation. only kidding, Graham, but it would be good.
They've got the money.
Should we just write it on there?
Rory Hyde joining us in the studio again.
Good.
Rory, welcome back. And, geez, what a lot of events, news and reviews tonight.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff on. In the near future, big news, a bit of a coup for Melbourne scene, is Jean Nouvel, the very famous Frenchie, is going to come and give a talk.
Pritzker Prize winner?
Pritzker Prize. I'm sure he's won every big prize in architecture. The Triple A, the Architecture Association Australia.
That's the one.
Sydney-based organisation who have done a great job bringing out some big names. They brought out Zumthor last year. And he's speaking on the 10th of October, so we'll let you know closer to the date.
We are in discussions with them about
interviews.
So hopefully that will come off.
And it's not crazily expensive this time, this Triple A event, which is good.
Really?
No, it's not crazy.
Good.
I can't remember what it was, but I'm thinking...
It's not $100 like that.
No, it's like $40 or $25
or
something.
Yeah, that's more like it.
What else you got there, Roy?
Well, Modernism Map. Now, this is something that Stewie and I and a whole lot of other people have been involved. Dan Hill, City of Sound Dan, has initiated this collaborative project in response to his...
The Powerhouse Museum?
The one that is crap, that we reviewed it a couple of weeks ago, Modern Times at the Powerhouse in Sydney.
So does it have something to do with that show? Or?
No.
He
reviewed it, and his position is he doesn't like to give, criticism without making a suggestion, constructive criticism.
So he said what this
exhibition needs to do is, use the modernism that's in the city, engage that a bit more, spread out,
right.
Move out from the gallery. So
good on you, Dan.
He sent an email to a handful of us from around the country and said, just flag these, your modernism buildings in your city. So I sat down and flipped through Goad, basically, and found some photos. on my Flickr already and plugged them on there. And in the end, after only a week, there's 180 buildings listed around the country.
It's a full, and it's using Google Maps.
Using Google Maps. So it's...
So there is a setup for it already, because there was no link there.
The link's on the website.
It is.
So you can
The link is pretty convoluted, but if you go... Dan's embedded it on his site, so if you go to cityofsound.com, and so is Marcus Trimble, who was another guy working on it, and also Canberra House, Martin.
I've used that website before. That Canberra House one is fantastic.
Yeah,
that is such a good resource.
We should do a proper thing on that. I'll get him on the phone, because he's done an amazing bit of lot of research up there on all of Canberra.
It's basically catalogued every modernist building in Canberra. Giving really good details of where they are and everything. It's great. It's a fantastic little resource.
So just having a little zoom around that modernism map is a good fun thing to do, and I recommend it indeed.
And there'll be more. It'll continue to expand over the coming weeks.
And the other thing, if you're an architect and you know about a lot of modernism, or you're not an architect and you want to get involved in this project, send Dan an email. It's on his website, and he'll invite you as a collaborator.
Especially some of the lesser known stuff. Yeah, like stuff in Darwin.
We're looking for people in Perth, Tassie, and up north.
Well, there'd be some ones in Perth, wouldn't there?
Yeah. In fact, that's my department. I'm running behind there a little bit, actually. We should move on. Yes. Now, we've got a few events. Architects for Peace, Words of Building 50.
This sounds like a good one, a good new project that I hadn't heard of. Construction giant GrowCon has entered a partnership with the Victorian Government, Yarra Community Housing, and the not-for-profit organisation Home Ground Services to build a supportive housing facility for the homeless in Elizabeth Street, based on the New York model known as Common Ground, which incorporates services the homeless may need in one facility. GrowCon's building it at cost, and many of the consultants are working at cost or pro bono basis. David Waldron from GrowCon design manager Victorian arm. He's going to talk about the venture, what's behind it, and how it will happen. This is on this Thursday, 7 p.m. RMIT Building 50, which is on Orr Street, which is off Victoria Street in Carlton, and presented by Architects for Peace.
Yes, indeed it is, and great organisation that they are. Now, a few reviews. We all have actually independently gone to see this great little show at the City Museum, and we should know the City Gallery. There's also another thing at the City Museum. Let's do Up first, which is at the City Gallery.
Which is in the Town Hall.
Which is in the Town Hall on Swanston Street, which is a little show dealing with verticality in Melbourne's architecture.
Well, it's actually a response to Louise Fortham, the artist who produced these, who's quite a well-known contemporary Melbourne artist. And
it's great three paintings.
He's a partner of a well-known architect in Melbourne as well, so it's just a good link to that. And her painting's sort of generally about the city, and she did these ones sort of, I think it was Tomorrow, Then, Now, Then and Before, or something like that.
And Tomorrow.
And this was a sort of response to that, but looked at a building, the Australia Building in 21 Elizabeth Street.
On Elizabeth Street, which was knocked down tragically and was the tallest building in the world, apparently for a very short period of time in the late 19th century. Amazing building and brutally destroyed. And now exists very potently in people's minds as this sort of great piece of boom-style Victorian architecture.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was talking about that sort of history where Melbourne was, in fact, as tall, you know, it was in the league of sort of New York and Chicago as one of the tallest cities in the world.
And one of the biggest cities in the world in the late 19th century as well.
And they put this was the fire engineers' dictum that they couldn't have any buildings over the height of the retractable ladder. That they had, the biggest ladder they had. So that really put a height limit right across Melbourne for quite some years afterwards. In fact, until ICI House came along.
And what a beautiful story this is that the show tells, Noddy, about the misprint of the height.
The Australian building was designed by Henry Kemp too, in 1888.
Thank you there. Yes, but the ICI House, of course, broke the old height limit, partly by being outside of the city of Melbourne in East Melbourne, and it was 202, was it, Noddy? And it got written up...
203.
But it got written up the feet, but it got written up at 230 feet. So on the planning permit or equivalent document, it says you can't build more than 230 feet. So then they changed the design, so it was 230 feet. So it actually made it higher.
Yeah, the architects were sort of blind. I said, I couldn't believe they actually gave us another 27 feet of space on the building. Because they were pushing outside the envelope as
already,
it was.
Yes, that's right. The old 40 metre height limit that you were talking about before. So it had already gone outside of that, and then went out again, and that actually became the new height limit then for a while, the 230 feet height limit. And this show really tells this story about verticality and height really well. It's only a very little show, but it's great. It's a nice little free catalogue.
There was a couple of quotes in there which I did like, and Robin Boyd called it, this is ICI House when it was opened in 1958, and it was of course designed by Bates, Smart and McCutcheon, Stewie, which are the oldest architecture firm in the world apparently.
Yeah, well they started with Joseph Reed in 1952.
Yes, now called Bates, Smart.
And still running.
Robin Boyd described it as refreshing as a glass of iced water, while Norman Lindsay, the artist, said it was an abominable glass anthill.
And we're of course talking about the glass cube number one Nicholson Street, up which is opposite the park in East Melbourne.
Orica House now.
Orica,
yeah. Sorry, Orica House, of course, these days. So up, like, great little show there. I can't find the name of the curator. Sorry about that. I will endeavour to do that. The other show that's on at the City Museum, which is, of course, in the old Treasury building at the top of Collins Street.
Robin Anear is the curator.
Robin Anear. And Peter Barrett is the curator of the Impermanent City at the City Museum, which, Rory, is one of these another show that deals with this idea of Melbourne's sort of unbuilt nature. There's been a few of these things along this theme recently.
So, along with the Unbuilt Melbourne audio guide, which is ongoing down at the National Design Centre. So this one's looking at the demolished buildings in Melbourne. So Hannah Bertrand, who's a visual artist, Simon Gregg, the curator down there, and the historian Peter Andrew Barrett has put it together, and it opens
September 6th.
In a couple of days.
Yes,
so get down there, have a look at it. We'll review it, but it sounds really interesting. And Peter Barrett was involved in a show there a couple of years ago on sort of more plagiarism or sort of influence copying in architecture.
Yeah, that was great.
What's that show called?
Rebuilding, I think. I found the really catalogue the other day. Another really good, looking at the Melbourne's version of an international building, or how we'd sort of rip that off.
Yes, so that's the Impermanent City. That's coming, starting very soon. That's almost all we've got time for this evening.
For process?
Oh, yes, Simon. Review. Yes. Process last night. Landscape. Yes, SK.
I thought it was a really good process last night. I thought it was fantastic. And
of course, at the Loop Bar.
It's designed by Jeff Crosby. And it... surprisingly, and the process must have been going for about nearly 4.5 years now, they've never had a landscape person on before. So this was their sort of...
major oversight.
Yeah, it was a bit of a major oversight, like this show has done at times. But
one we're correcting.
One we are correcting. But so they had three landscapers on. Chris Sawyer from Site Office, Sue-Ann Ware, who's an academic and practitioner from RMIT, and also and a much more established practitioner, which is Steve Cahoon from Tract, which are one of the... Big
firms
in Melbourne, and it was thoroughly engaging. I really enjoyed it. Really well put together, and all three of them had some really different things to say, but all really interesting in their own right. So,
Landscape Architects still trying to design do form?
No, I think they all talk about public realm.
I think that's public realm.
Well, I mean, Sue-Ann Ware's that deals with memorials, so hers was quite a different sort of thing and quite ephemeral temporal works. But I think most of them are about sort of, I think landscapers are going into this, something that Jeff was sort of alluding to previously, is sort of urban design kind of placemaking ideas rather than gardens or you know, green landscaping and such.
Yeah.
It's been going on for a while, but I think there's I don't necessarily about buildings, but the spaces within between buildings, definitely.
Yes. Well, we'll be hearing more about that from Sue-Ann Ware, who's coming on the show in a few weeks, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully 2 weeks' time, I think.
Yes, we'll confirm that closer to the time. That's about all we've got time for tonight.
Next week, Stewie.
Peter Hogg, will be on talking about Architeam and what he does.
Yeah, he's a director at the Architeam Group, which is a collective of architects, and he's also a long-time practitioner and done lots of things in architecture, so it'll be interesting to speak to him next week.
Yes, as we heard from Kirsten, the Venice Biennale is about to start. I won't be here for the next 2 weeks, as I'll be over there covering it for the show. I'll be calling in about 2 weeks' time, in fact, on the ground there in Venice, and hopefully getting some interviews and stuff and finding out all the exciting things that are happening in the different national pavilions at the Venice Biennale. That's all we've got time for. Mr. Nick Taylor, the Madman, is coming up right next. Podcast, as always, thanks to Andrew, and these guys will see you next week.